our unit discussing the Mikdash, the Mishkan, all the vessels that are contained thereof. And today I wanted to discuss the Aron, the Holy Ark. We'll go through just the basics of what it is, then we'll discuss the symbolism of it. I brought my picture book again, so you can just get a visual. They have better ones. This is a very old picture book. They have much better ones these days, but this is the one I had at home. They make very nice ones now.
This beautiful, like, thick one with the...
Yeah, right. Right, yeah. They have ones with photos. They have some with just better illustrations. All sorts of different things now. This is the one I think when I was a kid, this was, like, in the schools back then, you know? This has been around a long time.
A couple years ago.
It's all relative, I guess. Yeah, or 20 years back or something. But the, So the Aron, the Holy Ark, was composed of three different boxes. Here's a picture. I'm not going to discuss the covering on top. That we'll discuss in the coming week. But the Holy Ark itself had three boxes. The inner one and outer one are made of gold. The middle one was made out of atzei shittim, shittim wood, which is a type of cedar wood. That's the inner box. But this is the middle box. But the inner and outer were made of gold. The dimensions of the Aron, as the Torah describes them, just read it to you. We're using dimensions of an amma. An amma is approximately 1.5 to 2 feet, an amma. So depending on which opinion you use. But we'll talk about an amma, let's call it, just for argument's sake, 2 feet is an amma. So dimensions of the ark were there is 2.5 ammas long, 1.5 wide, and 1.5 high. And we'll discuss how the dimensions make a big difference. We'll talk about the symbolism of these dimensions themselves, because every single detail of the Mishkan carries within a lot of meaning and a very powerful message. So that was the dimensions of the Holy Ark, the Aron. As we said, you have three boxes, the middle one being wood. There is a question discussed as an aside, where did they find the cedar wood in the middle of the desert? They built the Mishkan in the middle of the desert, and they built the Ark. And there's a lot of sources that ask the question, in the middle of the desert, you don't find cedar trees growing. So the gold they could have taken from the Egyptians at the sea, right? We do have accounts that they took a lot of the booty and the spoils from the Egyptians and their horses at the sea. Because the horses were all decorated, the Egyptians had their armor and they're decorated, they had a lot of wealth with them. But where do you get cedar trees in the middle of the desert? So there are different answers given. Some say that Yaakov foresaw through prophecy that the Jews would need to have cedar trees in the desert, and he planted them in Egypt. So the Jews would take, and Jews had a tradition that they should take these cedar trees with them when they left Egypt. That's one opinion. One opinion is that Yaakov actually brought the cedar from Israel before he went down to Egypt. And again, they carried it out of Egypt based on their tradition. They're supposed to bring it out of Egypt. They didn't know why. But they had a tradition from Jacob. They should bring it out of Egypt. Some say it was through a miracle that it grew in the middle of the desert, that God provided miraculously cedar trees in the desert for this purpose. And another opinion says that a lot of non-Jewish merchants would actually come to the Jews in the desert to sell wares, and some of them came and sold cedar wood. That's the other opinion. So four different opinions as to where they found cedar wood in the middle of the desert.
These are all legitimate opinions, but they're so different. Yeah, they're
yeah
really,
but they're all based on very early sources. Yeah, it's all different Rishonim, different sources. Early sources, you know, very legitimate early sources. So that's just the side question of where you find cedar wood in the middle of a desert. But they had cedar wood. One way or the other, they had the cedar wood, and they built the ark. A lot of parts of the Mishkan built out of cedar wood. The as you see in the picture, the outer box contained what's called here, it's called the zer in Hebrew. It's kind of like a crown, a trim going around the top of it. And we put it all together, that trim would come up over the covering, over the kaporis. So when you put this thing, when you assemble it, this trim will rise up over the edges. That's called the zer. And we'll discuss how only three different vessels in the Mishkan had this trim. And we'll discuss the significance of that. There are golden rings on either end for the poles. It's actually a dispute where the rings were. This shows them kind of towards the top. Some say the rings were on the bottom. Some say they're actually four rings, not two rings. There's a dispute of how the rings were situated. Wait, let's see the picture. But there's certainly rings there for the poles to go through. And there's poles made out of, again, the cedar wood, coated in gold, which went through these rings. There is a prohibition in the Torah never to remove these poles. These poles have to remain in there, and they should not come out. And we'll discuss why that is as well, what the symbolism of that might be. But I guess that's the basic image of the Aron. Contained inside the Aron are the were and are the Luchos, the tablets brought down from Moshe and Mount Sinai, The broken tablets were contained in there as well. At a certain point, the broken tablets were stored in there too. There was a Torah scroll written by Moshe himself, the original Torah scroll. It was a dispute in the Gemara if that Torah scroll was kept in the Ark or on a shelf that was protruding from the Ark, next to the Ark. So that's a dispute where there's certainly a Torah scroll went along with the Ark. Question was it inside or was it next to? That was the question. But there's certainly a Torah scroll involved with the Ark. There are other things that were kept in the Holy of Holies with the Ark that weren't in the Ark itself, such as a jar of the man that Jews ate in the desert. The staff of Aaron, which sprouted in the story of Korach, in Parshas Korach, is a miracle to prove who was the rightful high priest. Aaron's staff sprouted overnight, and that staff was kept in the Holy of Holies. That's a story we can discuss at a different time. It also seems to be from the Rambam that they kept the jar of the anointing oil in the Holy of Holies as well. In addition, there seems to have been a scroll containing the names of a god stored in the Ark as well. So the Gemara has a source for that. There's a scroll containing all of God's names stored inside the Ark. So those are all the different items, the various items you'd find in and around the Ark. The Book of Chronicles, Divrei Yamim, records, and the Gemara explains this, that what happened to the Ark? Where did it go? So we have a tradition it was not carried away by the Babylonians when they destroyed the temple. Rather, the Ark was hidden in tunnels under the Temple Mount itself. So the Gemara tells us that King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, when he built the temple, he foresaw through prophecy that there would be a destruction. He wanted to make a safe place to hide away the Aron in case that ever came out into fruition. So he actually had built under the Temple Mount all sorts of tunnels, twisting and turning deep underground as a hiding place for the Ark if ever the enemies came in to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. And King Yoshiyahu, who actually he was a very good king, but he foresaw that we were approaching the destruction of the first temple. And during his days, he commanded the, I guess it was the Levites at the time, I think it was the Levites, to take the Aron down into these tunnels and hide it away. And at that point, the Aron was hidden away, it's still hidden in those tunnels to this very day, based on our tradition. The second temple, there was no Aron in the second temple. In the second temple, the Holy of Holies was empty. There was just a stone in there, but there was no Aron. So only the first temple until the times of Yoshua Melch was there an Aron in the Holy of Holies.
So we can see this if we go down to the basement of the first...
Well, we don't know where it is, but technically it's down there somewhere. Right. Yeah, we don't know where those tunnels are. But technically, according to the Gemara, if we were to excavate the Temple Mount and dig down somewhere, somehow we'd be able to find the Aron. I mean, there are all sorts of stories of people, getting a glimpse of some special light in this hole over here. Or there's all sorts of stories you can hear, different traditions as to what could happen to it, where it could be. This old movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, with Indiana Jones, which they were trying to find the Lost Ark. That's probably all. Based on the story that it was hidden away somewhere. Yeah, I mean, I don't remember the movie I saw 25 years ago. I don't remember it anymore, but whatever it is. But that was the basis of that movie. But, I mean, there are different traditions and stories both in the Gemara, in the Mishnah, and beyond for people having found a glimpse of it or a special light coming out of the ground. Or there's a story even in the Mishnah. There was a loose tile in the second temple, and somebody moved the loose tile and they saw a hole, and then that person, I think, died shortly after, and there was some tradition that maybe he actually saw the Ark himself. But there are stories like that throughout history. But bottom line is we don't know where it is. But it was not taken away by the enemies. It was hidden away, the Gemara says. So even though you have the other vessels of the temple were actually taken away by the enemies, both the Babylonians and the second temple, the Romans, carried away the famous Arch of Titus, which you can see in Rome to this very day, pictures them carrying away the menorah. Mm-hmm. But the Ark was not taken by the enemies. The Ark remains as is to this very day. And we hope to recover it, God willing, in the near future. So that's the story of the Aron, what it looked like, what was in it, what was around it, and where it went. So now let's discuss some of the symbolism and lessons from the structure and details of the Aron itself. So I guess first and foremost, we call it, in Hebrew, the word is Aron. You should make an Aron. The word Aron, so in modern Hebrew, a closet is called an Aron, in modern Hebrew. We know in the shul we have the Aron Kodesh in the front, which contains the Torah, which obviously is borrowing the term from the Holy Ark in the temple, which contained the tablets. But the word Aron itself, sources say, have a few different meanings. The word Aron is composed of the same letters as the word Or, of light. The letters can be rearranged to mean Oran, their light. Because the Torah is called our light. Torah is Or, Torah is light. And the Aron is the container for the Torah. So since the Aron contains the light of the Jewish people, that which illuminates our lives and teaches us and shows us the right way. So it gets the name Aron, playing off the word or of light. Additionally, if you rearrange the letters in Aron, the Baal HaTurim points out, it forms the word Nora. Nora means awesome, evoking fear. We call God in the Shemoneh Esrei, HaKel HaGadol HaGibor VaNora, the God who is great and strong and Nora and awesome. That's the word Nora. So the same letters of Aron also connotes the fear of God, the awe of God, because this contains, you know, the awe of God. This is in terms of everything in this world, this is the most, you know, godly vessel which exists in the world. So that's Nora. The numerical value of Aron, the Baal Torah points out, is the same numerical value as the word Nezer, which is 357. And the word Nezer means a crown, because the Torah, the Holy Ark, is our crowning jewel, represents the crown of Torah that a person can achieve, that if we devote ourselves to the Torah, we can achieve greatness, and we can become great people. That's the idea of the crown of Torah. So the word Aron has that same gematria, same numerical value as Nezer. Yeah.
Is Nezer that the similar word to Nazir? Is it related?
Yeah, it's related. Right. This is this idea also. He's also containing a crown of God, and that he's withdrawing from this world for the sake of God. He also has a crown, in some way. Nezer Elokav. That's the word Aron. It's an interesting note. We discussed last week how the construction of the Mishkan is supposed to be a model of the construction of the creation of the world. Creation of the world and the construction of the Mishkan kind of mimic each other. So the first thing created in the world was light. God said, let there be light. That's the first thing we see in creation. And the first thing created for the Mishkan is the Aron, which is the same letters as Or, as light. So you just see that connection in the two, that the Aron is our light, and when God created the world, he first created the light. So that's just an interesting reference to what we discussed last week. When God commands us to create the Aron, we see a difference in the language used versus the other vessels of the Mishkan. When God tells us to build the other vessels of the Mishkan, he says, V'asisa, you should create, the you there being singular. When it comes to the Aron, it says, V'asu, which is you in plural. I mean, we'd say y'all in the south, where I'm from, you know. So when the other vessels are created, it says, you singular should make this vessel, speaking to Moshe and thereby to Bezalel, who was the one who constructed the Mishkan. When it comes to the Aron, it's V'asu, that y'all should create the Mishkan. The you in plural should create the Mishkan. This is the Aron. See, the Aron. Because the Aron is you should create the Aron. So what's the significance of that? So the Medrash teaches us, it's quoted by many sources, that every single Jew has to be involved in building the Aron. Now, it says in the beginning of Parshas Truma, we requested donations for the Mishkan. People were not required to donate for every single element of the Mishkan. So my donation, if I just brought in my cedar wood, so it would go things in need of wood. I just brought in cloth, so go things that required cloth. But when it comes to the Aron, every single Jew has to be involved in creating the Aron. That might mean through helping to build it. That might mean through donations, which are designated for the Aron itself. The Ramban, Nachmanides, says, may even just be that you think about building the Aron, that you have kavana for it. However that would work out, but you have some sort of intent in your mind that I want to be part of the Aron. Everyone had to have their portion in building the Aron. The symbolism of that seems to be that, because the Aron represents the Torah. The Aron contains the Torah, this is our source of Torah in the world. And every single Jew has a responsibility to connect to the Torah itself. The other vessels of the Mishkan aren't directly connote Torah. Other vessels of the Mishkan might connote service of God, sacrifice, the kindness. So those are all virtues of a Jew. But the Torah itself is our life force. Torah is our blood. Every single Jew has to donate and devote themselves to the Torah and make that relationship in some way. So therefore, even though when it comes to the other vessels, it was said in singular that you, Moshe, you should make sure that this gets built. But when it comes to the Aron, it's in plural, because every single Jew has to have their stake in the Aron, because that represents the Torah itself. Additionally, supporting Torah also gives somebody portion in Torah, in terms of Torah study. So we have a concept based on many sources. One of the most famous sources is the deal between the tribes of Yisachar and Zebulun, that the tribe of Yisachar used to study Torah all day long, and they were supported by Zebulun, the tribe of Zebulun. And the rabbis teach us that the way, if you yourself cannot study Torah, but you support a Torah scholar, then it's equivalent, you get part of that person's reward for studying Torah, just by supporting it. which can be applied in many ways in terms of, you know, supporting shuls and yeshivas and other types of areas where Torah study happens. But the supporting the Torah study is also as if you study Torah yourself. We have the famous verse says, Eitz Chaim Yemachazikim Bo. We say we lift up the Torah, it's the tree of life for those who are machzikim bo, which means those who support it. So because supporting Torah itself is tantamount to learning Torah. So therefore, every Jew giving their donation to the Aron to represent this concept of supporting Torah. That's explained by the famous commentary, the Kli Yakar. And based on this, the Gemara tells us that people should try their best to support Torah scholars, because we see that every single Jew had to be involved in the building of the Aron. I didn't have to give a donation for the altar. I didn't give a donation for the table showing the showbreads, for the walls of the Mishkan. I didn't have to give for any of those purposes. But in terms of the Aron itself, everyone had to be involved in the building of the Aron in some way, which teaches us our responsibility for connecting to Torah and connecting those who study Torah.
Where specifically did the
Kli Yakar
say? I heard about the mitzvah, but where did he come in?
Which one? Say it again? Kli Yakar. He's the one who says that this represents supporting Torah. That everyone donating to the Aron represents the support of Torah study. So that's the symbolism of the Asu, that it's in plural, that, you know, we'll call it y'all. I have the license to say that I'm from Atlanta. So y'all should make the Aron. We used to have some other Southerners here too. They're not, you know, we used to have Laura coming. She can relate with my y'all.
Yeah.
Oh, else? Okay.
Did I tell you I grew up in Augusta?
I didn't know that. Oh, wow. Okay. So you can also relate to the y'all. Good. Next is the materials used. So the materials, we said, you have wood in the middle, cedar wood, and the outer and inner boxes are made of gold. So what's the significance of the materials? Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch discusses at length the significance of each material used in the construction of the Mishkan, starting from the wool, from the different color dyes they would use, the gold, the silver, the copper. Every material has its own significance. So what does the wood represent? The idea of cedar wood, cedar is considered one of the strongest trees, one of the strongest woods, most durable woods. But the idea of wood itself, wood represents something which grows, it's developed, it's organic. Wood grows. Metal doesn't grow. A tree represents to us growth and development. So the reason that this middle box of the Aron was made out of wood, so Rav Hirsch describes that Torah should help us grow and develop and progress and bear fruit like a tree. The Torah is the way a human being is able to grow and become a bigger and better person. That helps to develop a human being. And that helps us be productive and eventually bear fruits in life, eternal fruits. That's what Torah does for us. So to have the middle box of the Aron wood is that message to us, that the wood is something which helps its progression and development and growth. As a contrast, the tablets were made of stone. Because the Torah itself is like a stone in that it is unchanging. The Torah itself is set in stone, literally. That's why the tablets were set in stone. And therefore the tablets, which represent the Torah in its entirety, those are made out of stone because the Torah itself does not change. But the Torah should lead us to change. So the Aron, which represents those who are studying Torah, that's made of wood. The tablets, which are the Torah in its essence, are made out of stone. That's what Hirsch describes. But the coating is in metal. So we have golden coating. So the central box, I guess that's the main part of the Aron, is a piece of wood. But it's coated on both sides with metal. So Rabbi Hirsch describes that metal is something which represents power, perseverance. It's the strongest material. That's why you make a sword and a knife out of metal. It cuts. It's resistant to change. Gold especially is resistant to deterioration and to rust. So one who studies Torah, we have to have this inner development and growth, inner drive to become better people and to change in terms of our inner selves. We also have to have a perseverance and consistency which doesn't change. The Gemara says that, well, before we get to the Gemara, so gold is something which is pure without defect. In terms of all metals, gold is the purest of metals that we use. Gold is something which doesn't rust. Gold is something which lasts. Because that shows the purity, that Torah has to lead us to be pure people. People without defect, people who don't deteriorate. So we have to have an attitude of perseverance, like metal, because metal is so strong and metal is unchanging. And the idea of gold is that purity of gold, you know, that doesn't deteriorate. The Gemara, Maseches Yuma, it describes to us the inner and outer box for gold. So it says that a true Torah scholar is what's called Tocho Kebaro. his inside is outside match. To find, when we see somebody who looks nice and religious on the outside, but on the inside, you know that they're kind of corrupt. You know, the message which they express is contradictory to how they live their lives. They're people who we would look at as kind of two-sided people. So that's not a true Torah scholar. A true Torah scholar is somebody who is tochel kebar, who is inside and is outside match. If you're gold on the outside, but you're not gold on the inside, then you're not gold. That's not a true Torah scholar. A true Torah scholar is somebody who has both outer and inner purity. So Torah can never be external. Torah has to be something which gives you an inner purity and devotion, which is always there as well, as the Gemara says. So that's why we have the inner part is, the middle part is the wood, and then the inner and outer part. So you have to have a match of the inner and outer part, being that you're gold both inside and out, to be a true Torah, a person who's devoted to Torah, a true Jew. Yes.
So are there like certain prophets that we would declare like Abraham or Moses? That we would say are true Torah? We probably wouldn't say everybody is, so.
Well, usually somebody who's been accepted as a Torah great, usually the understanding is that person is inside and out devoted to God. I mean, I think it was the famous Chazon Ish. I think he was, the greatest rabbi in Israel in the early 20th century. So I think he was one to say that he was asked, "How do we choose our Torah greats? We don't elect our Torah giants. The Gedolim are not chosen. People who we all respect to as the authority in Torah." Who said? Where did that come from? So I think it was the Chazon Ish who answered that the Jewish people have an innate sense to find those people who are sincere and honest and knowledgeable enough to be our Gedolim. So somebody who we've actually accepted throughout the ages as a Torah great, usually that indicates to us that they are people who are through and through devoted to God. Somebody who's not through and through devoted to God usually doesn't make the cut. Usually we sense something is off about that person and we don't make them the people that we respect. So those people, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Moshe, these people we look at, they were through and through devoted to God. The tests given to Abraham were to prove that point. That if you're not just externally preaching the message of God, but internally you still don't believe and you're not devoted, I'm going to test you inside and out to make sure that you're totally devoted to God. And that applies to all Torah greats throughout history. The people who were through and through devoted to God, they became accepted as the Torah scholars of the Jewish people. And those who are not, usually we were able to pick them out, because we sense something is off. Even just very day, sometimes you meet somebody, they look very religious externally, but after you get to know them for a while, you realize something's a little bit off here. I don't know, but like maybe they're acting more pious than they really are. We usually sense that about people. So I think that's the, it's kind of a self-selecting process. That's how I understand it. Another interesting point about the same idea of the gold being inside and out. So if you look carefully at the words of the Pasuk, it says, read it to you. Betipiso so Zahav Tahor, you should cover the ark with pure gold from the inside, and from the outside you should cover it. So it mentions the word covering twice. And then it says, and you should make, Vasisalov Zerosov, so you should make this crown going around it. But it stresses on the inside, it says you should use pure gold. And on the outside, it doesn't repeat again that you should use pure gold. It just says you should cover it from the outside as well. It implies you should use the gold. It doesn't stress that it was pure gold. So again, the same commentary you quoted before, the Kli Yakar, he says that the reason we stress the pure gold on the inside is because naturally people want to look good on the outside. So I don't have to stress to be pure on the outside, because everyone wants to look good on the outside. I don't want people looking at me funny. So I want to look pure on the outside. But Torah has to put an extra stress on the fact that we should be pure on the inside as well, because a person has to be through and through a good person. We don't like having that contradiction in a human being. You want to be a person who looks externally and internally as pure. So Torah stresses that internally also you have to be pure. He also, the same commentary, Kli Yakar, describes that an action which is done quietly, that action usually is naturally a pure action. Because I'm doing it when no one else is watching. I'm doing it because it's right. Actions done in the public eye, so those aren't always with pure intentions. It depends. An action done in the public eye, an action done externally, okay, sometimes it's done with pure and sincere intent. Other times you're doing it for other reasons. Maybe you're doing it so people honor you. Maybe you're doing it so people respect you. Maybe you're doing it because you have something to ask. You want to ask a favor from someone else. So first you show how nice you are. But things you do privately, between yourself and God, typically it's because you have a pure intent. Because why no one else is watching you, why are you doing this action? So he says that when it's in another take on this verse, when it stresses that the inside is made of pure gold, that's teaching us that internal actions typically are pure, naturally. External actions aren't not always so pure. It depends on the person, depends on the situation. So that's another message which can be taken from this verse. So now I'd like to discuss the dimensions. I keep telling you that dimensions mean a lot in the Mishkan. And you know, we read over these verses, and each different vessel has different dimensions. And God said, you have to make it to these dimensions. So the question is, what's the significance of the dimensions? So what's unique about the Ark is that, as I mentioned before, the dimensions are 1.5 by 1.5 by 2.5. We're using amos, which is approximately 2 feet, but it's 1.5, 1.5 by 2.5 amos. The commentaries point out that all the dimensions are halves. They're not whole dimensions, they're all halves. 1.5, 1.5, 2.5, they're all halves. What's the significance of each direction being a half? So I read three different approaches to this question of what the significance of a half is. I mean, a half always seems to connote something broken. It's not a full piece, it's a broken piece. That's what a half is. If God could have said you should make it 2 by 2 by 3, but God says 1.5, 1.5 by 2.5. Each one should be a half, which connotes something broken, something not complete. So one approach to this question is from the Baal HaTurim, who was, he lived, I think, around the 1500s, on the famous commentaries on the Torah and also in Halacha. And he writes that studying Torah requires humility. So the idea of a half symbolizes to us being, we feel a little bit broken. We can't be so high and full of ourselves. We shouldn't have arrogance. Studying Torah requires you to be humble, because we have to humble ourselves in front of God's Word. And if we're not humble, it's very difficult to accept the Torah. Yes?
I heard that, like, if you had to make a piece of clothing,
yeah,
like a man's tie or something, on the back of it had a flaw, because nothing is supposed to be perfect. Is that similar to this?
I guess so. Yeah, I never heard that before, but I guess it ties in.
That there is a genius who does fashion, but when he makes men's clothing or ties, he does a little flaw right on the back.
It's interesting.
Because nothing can be perfect.
Uh-huh. Okay, yes, that has it for sure.
If one has something in their house, their mind, that would have to be broken.
Well, you mean something in the three?
Yeah.
You know, like a painting wasn't a really little spot?
Yeah, right.
They find it, like if you had, if it was a person or something, you would have a finger broken off, you would have something, wouldn't be perfect.
Uh-huh. Oh, for the house, it's...
Well, I mean, there is a concept in terms of remembering the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash to leave something in your house broken, or maybe when you're painting, you should leave a square, that type of thing. But, I mean, this is saying, unique to Torah study, it requires humility. That's more of a sign of mourning, a sign as though our lives are incomplete at this point, because we don't have a holy temple. But there's also the concept of Torah study itself requires a measure of humility. And therefore, if a person who's not humble, I think it's obvious, there's many sources to say that person cannot become a Torah scholar, because if you're too arrogant, you're not going to fully understand the text, you're going to think you know better, you're going to think that this is the right way to understand it, you're going to think, well, I should do it this way because I feel is right, and I don't care what the scholar said before me. So you have to have humility to study Torah. So the idea of a half piece, that itself connotes humility. That's the Baal HaTurim. The Kli Yakar again, the same commentary we quoted before, he says that in the world of Torah study, we have to always see ourselves as lacking, so we strive for more. As opposed to, let's say, when it comes to our earthly possessions, so we're supposed to be sameach bechelka, we should be happy with our lot, we should feel complete, I have what I need. Yaakov tells his brother Esav, yesh li kol, I have everything. Because when it comes to physical possessions, I should feel content. God gave me what I have, I'm happy with it, I don't need to push myself and strive for more, because I have what I need. That's the ideal attitude we should have towards our earthly possessions. When it comes to spiritual growth and spiritual gaining, especially in the world of Torah knowledge, we should always see ourselves as lacking. I can always know more, I can always study more, I can always do better. And we can, if we view ourselves as complete in the world of Torah study, then we're going to come to stagnation. We're not going to be growing anymore. So when it comes to Torah study, you always see yourself as a half. There's always more I can do, always more I can know. It goes on and on. So that's the significance of the half pieces according to the Kli Yakar. Another very interesting approach, a very different approach, is explained by Rav Shimshon Pinkus. We quoted him before in this class. He was a very, very recent scholar who died tragically in a car accident about 10 years ago. He's an American, lived in Israel. he traveled around both America and Israel, giving very powerful speeches, inspiring people. So he was killed in a car accident about 10 years ago now, I think. Yeah, right, that's something. They put out a lot posthumously from him. In his lifetime, I think he wrote 3 books in Hebrew, that was it. Once, after he was killed, they put out, dozens, a lot of things based on his recording, based on his writings.
Pincus, yeah.
Both in English and Hebrew, you can find all sorts of stuff from him now. He was a very, very powerful, emotional person, Shimshon Pincus. So he writes the significance of the idea of the half, one of the half dimensions of the Ark. He says that when I mention a half, so that implies that there's another half out there. It implies a partnership, a relationship, and two halves make a whole. So he says that Torah study, in all ways, in all parts, create a relationship with God. Literally or metaphorically, its breadth, its width, its height of Torah study, no matter which way you go, there's a half, which means there's another half. And God is the one who is the other half of the Torah study. So as we study Torah, and that which we, the effort to put into studying Torah, that creates a relationship with someone else, which is God. That creates a partnership with God. So Torah study has to be viewed as a way to create a relationship. And that's why you have half dimensions when it comes to the Ark, which represents Torah study. So every single way you study Torah in all areas, that brings you to a deeper connection with God, a relationship with God. And you can look at it in many ways. He says that when you talk about height, metaphorically, the idea of height, we call those kind of more spiritual, mystical type studies. You're things which kind of move you out of this world. So there is a train of thought out there, not a Jewish train of thought, but a train of thought out there, which is that the way you connect with God is through mysticism, through things which we would call more spiritual, lofty things. But you don't connect to God through everyday life. The Torah is not like that. The main part of the Torah is about everyday life. There's halacha deals with very, very mundane things, monetary law, business law, how to conduct ourselves in eating, in drinking, in marriage. These are things which are very much on our breadth and width of our lives, on this plane, not on that plane. But yet, those also connect you to God. We can never think that Torah study doesn't connect you with God when it's talking about mundane matters, because every matter the Torah discusses is a holy matter. And it's telling you the will of God in those holy matters. You pick up, and people, you always use an example, you look at Parshas Mishpatim, or you pick up the Talmud, you look at certain parts of the Talmud, and you have discussions, pages and pages, about an ox goring another ox, or an ox eating your apple, and who has to pay who. And it looks like you're reading a law book, but this is the Holy Torah. And this also connects you with God in the same way that studying some sort of Kabbalistic, higher mystical thing also connects you with God. So both in the breadth, the length, and the height of the Ark, you have half measurements to show you that no matter how you study Torah, in any area, those all connect you to God equally. That's the message he says, based on half dimensions. One more time here. The next point mentioned is in the pasuk itself. It says that we should create on the Ark a zer zahav saviv, this crown, this trim going around the Ark. It was on the outer box, and we put it all together. It went over the covering. I'm not sure how high it was, but went over the covering a little bit from the outer box. That's this. 3 vessels in the Mishkan, the Beis Mikdash as well, had this crown on it. The Aron, the golden altar, which was incense was offered upon, and the shulchan, the table that displayed the showbreads. So I guess we have pictures here. I can find it. This is the golden altar, also had this crown going around it. And the table with the showbreads also had a crown going around it as well. Down here you can see it. So the golden altar, the table with the showbreads, and the ark all had this crown. So what's the significance of this crown? So there are many sources, both early and later sources, which describe that the Aron represents, as we've said, the Torah study. The altar, the golden altar, represents what we call avoda, the service of God. And the shulchan, the table, represents sustenance in this world. You put 12 breads weekly on the table. That represents taking care of others, chesed, which we can tie back to the famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, the world's stand of 3 things, on Torah, avodah gemus chasadim, on Torah, service of God, and chesed. So these 3 things represent those 3 ideals of Judaism, Torah, service of God, and chesed. In other words, you can relate it to Torah study, kahuna, priesthood, which represent the service of God, and the Malchus, the Jewish king, who represented taking care of other people. And the Mishnah, another Mishnah Perkei Avos tells us there are three crowns a person can have. You can have the crown of Torah study, you can have Keser Kahuna, the crown of being a Kohen, and Keser Malchus, the crown of being a king. So these three vessels represent those three crowns that you can achieve. So being a Kohen, if you're not born a Kohen, you can't achieve that crown. You can't be a king unless you're part of the Davidic dynasty. So we, if we are born into King David's dynasty, we can't be a king. But everyone can achieve the crown of Torah study. So this is the one of these three crowns which every Jew can attain. Everyone can attain the crown of greatness in Torah.
What if they have a mental retardation? They can't believe Torah study, but everybody can.
That's a good question. You know, I guess everyone on their own... The greatest in Torah study doesn't mean you're going to be the top scholar in the world. Because everybody who puts forth their best effort and excels in their own way, that's also greatness. The greatness is something which is relative to the person. It's not necessarily relative to the world. When we talk about greatness, it doesn't always mean because the world looks at you as great. It means that you're a big person. It means you've gone beyond who you yourself. You've worked yourself the best way possible. It's a very good question. The right. That's true. That's very true. That's very true. Sometimes a person who doesn't do much, right, but they are able to evoke so much chesed for others around them and their families and their communities, so they've also achieved greatness passively, but they've also achieved greatness. They brought out the best in others. That's also greatness as well. The zer, the crown, was not a separate piece attached. Rather, it was formed from the actual outer box. So it wasn't that they made a box, made a crown, and then they glued it on. Rather, the same piece of gold which was used to form the box, which is one piece of solid gold which they had to shape into the shape of the box. They also, from that, they made this crown. So Rav Hirsch describes that we have to view greatness in Torah study as a natural outgrowth of devotion. If we remain pure, naturally we become great. It's not that we do our best and then greatness is placed upon us, but it's a natural outcome of someone who's a devoted Jew devoting themselves to Torah study, devoting themselves to sincerely to God. So then that person automatically, naturally becomes noble. So it's an outgrowth of the actual process of devoting yourself to the Torah. It's not something external slapped upon you. So I guess the question we had before about how we choose our Torah greats. Nobody came and slapped the crown upon, you know, the Torah scholar says, you are now our Gadol Hador. Rather, because they spent so long studying and devoting themselves to God, it was naturally people came to respect them because it was a natural outgrowth of who they were. Most of those people who we label as, you know, the greatest, the Gadol Hador, many of them, they didn't have major positions. They weren't public figures. They sat in their room and they studied and they studied and they studied and they helped others and they cared and they davened and they devoted themselves to God, and then they were just, we had a sense, this person is a great person. People like the Vilna Gaon, who was the leader of all Jewry, you know, in his day, he didn't have a public position. He sat in his room and he studied and people just were drawn to him. He was able to guide and lead the Jews because he was such a great person on his own right. People like we mentioned before, the Chazon Ish himself, he didn't take on a public position. Really, he's only known at the very end of his life to be a great person. He just sat and he devoted himself to God for years and years on end. And people, it was like a magnet. People were drawn to him because there's a great person in our midst. We have to utilize him for his best. So it was a natural outgrowth of who he was. It wasn't something that we're saying, you are now considered our leader. That's not how it works. So that's the idea of these golden crowns on the Aron. We're kind of out of time here. I wanted to... Do we have 5 more minutes? A little bit over time. Okay, let's take 5 more minutes just so I can finish up the topic. The last part of the Aron which we did not discuss is these poles. The poles were pieces of wooden poles covered in gold. And we said that it's a permanent part of the Ark. It wasn't that we just needed it to pick it up and move it. And we did carry the Ark by these poles. But they were considered a permanent fixture in the Ark, as opposed to the other vessels had poles as well. As you can see, the altar has poles, the table had poles, everything had poles, but this you took out. When you put it down to do the service, you would take out the poles. When you picked it up to carry it through the desert, you put the poles on. The Aron had poles, and those poles remained. They were removable, but they were not allowed to be removed. It's a prohibition in the Torah to remove those poles. So what's the meaning behind that mitzvah? So there's several different approaches to it. One basic approach by the Sefer HaChinuch is, he says very simply, the Ark is so holy and so important, so we have to be able to move it at a moment's notice. So to have to go and find the poles and stick them in, might take us a little time. So it's always ready to move just in case. It's a very, very simple, very rational reason. So we always let the pulse in just in case we have to grab it, you know, at the moment's notice and move it away. Other commentaries describe that it's not respectful to be fidgeting around with the holy ark. To have to put the poles in, take them out, put them in, take them out. So it's a disrespect to the ark to have to always have your hands all over it. So therefore, we just leave the poles in. We don't touch it. We touch it as minimal as possible. And so if we have to carry it and move in the desert, when God says move, we pick it up and we move. But besides that, we don't fidget with it. We put it down and we run away in fear and awe of the holy ark. And then that's another commentators always point out, that the emas hakadusha, the awe of the holiness of this vessel doesn't allow us to touch it any more than necessary. Another commentator, the Ralbag, he describes that we have to view the ark as something which is always complete. If there is removable parts that went in and out of the ark, so we look at the vessel as lacking. So we still have to view ourselves as lacking in terms of Torah knowledge. But the actual Torah itself is 100% complete. The Torah is not lacking. So if the ark itself had a piece that had to be put in, taken out, put in, taken out, we would see it as a lacking in the Aron itself. So we have to view the Aron as 100% complete at all times, symbolizing the Torah is always complete, and the Torah is not lacking in any way. The Kli Yakar, we keep quoting, Kli Yakar describes that it's symbolic of the constant mitzvah of Torah study. Torah study is a constant. I mean, there's a verse in the book of Joshua, Yeshua, Lo Yamush Sefer Torah Zeripicha. This book of the Torah shall never leave your mouth. Torah study is a constant mitzvah we should be involved in as much as we can, every moment of our day. So having the poles in the ark are symbolic of that mitzvah, that it's something which is constantly relevant to us. Taking out the poles is saying, we're putting it down for now, we'll come back later. The poles are always there, it shows that the Torah is always on the move. The Torah is always something which is relevant and always in our lives. Similarly, Rav Hirsch describes that we have to look at Torah as without boundaries. If we were to take out the poles, we'd be saying the Torah belongs right here, in this room, the Holy of Holies, and I'm going to go and have my life outside the Holy of Holies. Torah is something which is part of our everyday lives, all parts of our life. We can never say the Torah is going to be isolated to a room, isolated to a day, isolated to shul, isolated to Shabbos, to Yom Kippur. We can never say such a thing. Torah is something which is relevant constantly, everywhere, every day, in all parts of our life. You can't confine it to the temple. So leaving the poles in shows the Torah is dynamic, it moves, it's everywhere. Taking out the poles is saying, okay, I'm putting you down over here and you're staying here, I'm not going to move you anymore. We can never have that attitude towards the Torah. I was just listening to a history lecture, and it was discussing Moses Mendelssohn, who was looked at as kind of the father of the Reform movement. And one of his quotes that are attributed to him is that a Jew should be a Jew in the house, but a cosmopolitan person in the German streets. So that's saying the Torah stays in my house. When I go out, the Torah stays there, and I go out here, and I'm a German now. We say, you know, God forbid a Jew should have that attitude. The attitude should be that the Torah has poles on it, which are always there, because the Torah goes with you wherever you go. You don't put the Torah down and leave it behind. You take it with you no matter where you go. So that's those are the lessons you find in the poles being on the ark constantly. And also tying into an idea we said earlier, we discussed the relationship of those who support Torah study to those who study the Torah. And having the poles represent the support of the Torah, because that's how you carry the ark. The ark is the Torah study itself. And having them constantly connected shows that there's a bond between those who support the Torah and those who study the Torah, which is inseparable.
Say that one more time, blend that through again.
The poles represent those who support Torah. Those who are able to, you know, support Jewish institutions, support yeshivas. The ark is the Torah study itself. That's what it represents. So having them together at all times, it shows how they work hand in hand. As we know, every Jewish institution needs those who work hard to fulfill its message, those who support and pay its bills, you know. And we know that all the institutions struggle for that very reason. But they work hand in hand. Support of Torah and fulfillment of Torah go together. And it's a constant mitzvah to study. But it's a constant mitzvah to support the Torah as well. And those are inseparable from one another. So these poles have to remain on the ark at all times to show that support of Torah is inseparable from the Torah study itself. Like we said before, concerning Yisachar and Zebulun, the two tribes work together. You have those who are paying the bills and have those who are studying the Torah. And together they share the reward because they go together hand in hand. The last point I want to make is that there's a very fascinating concept that when one was to view the Beis HaMikdash, so we know that no one went into the Holy of Holies, nobody ever saw the Ark, stayed in the room. The Kohen Gadol went in there once a year on Yom Kippur. He went in just one day a year. He went in there. He went in there five times Yom Kippur. So he was in there five times one day a year. The Kohen Gadol. But that was it. So nobody saw it. What did we see? So the Gemara tells us, based on a verse in the Book of Kings, that these poles actually were long enough that they would jut through the curtain, the paruchas, that separated the Holy of Holies from the rest of the temple. So they didn't actually make a hole, but you would actually see them poking out of the curtain. You would see the pokes in the curtain. They would kind of protrude through the curtain. And it's a very interesting thing. So if one was watching the Beis HaMikdash, you would not see the ark. I mean, you couldn't see the ark, it's behind a curtain. But you would see these two poles, protruding, into the curtain itself, poking through the curtain. So our perception of the Aron was through these poles. What do these poles represent? So the rabbis tell us in the Gemara, it says that the metaphor it uses, I'll tell you exactly their words. The metaphor they use is that they would push through and they would protrude through the curtain as two breasts of a woman. As it says in a verse in the Song of Songs, that God dwells amongst the, and we'll call it two breasts of a woman. That's what it says in the Song of Songs, in the metaphor. But that metaphor is a very powerful metaphor because it represents a nursing mother. And the fact the nursing mother is this kind figure who supports her child and provides for her child, takes care of her child, feeds her child. And the influence of God in this world, the blessings of God in this world, they come through that place, the Holy of Holies, through the Ark, out from there, out to the world. And those two poles representing that nursing mother, that's God providing our milk, our nourishment for our world. That's the metaphor of that scene. And you don't see the Ark itself, but you do notice is these two things jutting through the curtain, because you see, this is where God sends his blessing to the world through that curtain. Just like a mother nursing her baby, so too God provides for the entire world. That's the place where the influence of blessing comes to our world, through the Holy of Holies, out from that curtain, out to the rest of the world. We direct all of our prayers towards that place. We stand here in Maryland, we dive into the east, towards Israel. In Israel, everyone points towards Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, you point towards the temple. In the temple, you point to the Holy of Holies. That's where you focus your prayers, because the focal point of God's influence on our world is that point of the Holy of Holies and the Holy Ark itself. So we perceive God's blessing in our world coming from that room and spreading outwards from there. God willing, next week we'll discuss the covering with the cherubs and the covering of the ark, which it's its own separate discussion. But the Torah says that God communicates with Moses in between these cherubs. That's what the Torah itself says. We have to understand the message of that. So that, God willing, will be next week's discussion. Any questions? Yeah.
Is it predicted that the third temple will be when the Messiah comes? He'll rebuild
the third temple. He's going to build it. Yeah. And presumably he will recover the ark at that point and bring it to the Holy of Holies.
It's supposed to come down the hall from Shemayim. And if you understand, I don't know if this is a connection with the idea that everything's connected that we see here in this world is because of something that's in Shemayim anyway. Actually, I dream of it based on Shemayim.
Oh, wow.
I see all these things.
Interesting. Wow. I mean, what she's referencing, the Gemara does say that if we merit it, it will come down whole from the heavens, the Beis HaMikdash. If we don't merit that, so then it'll be built through construction. But either way, it seems to be in the times of the Messiah that will happen. He'll be the one who lays the groundwork for this to occur. First thing we got to do is get rid of the people who are inhabiting the Temple Mount as of now, and then we can move on from there. But that the Messiah will take care of that as well. That'll be, I guess, his first job. To clear the Temple Mount for the temple to be built. When that happens, God willing, we'll recover the Ark and put it back in Holy Holies once again.